In the preliminary remarks, we were already reminded of some of the important ideas which came up in our study last Sunday, because that study and this are directly linked as being studies of two out of the three paths to spiritual discipline. We were reminded that in theosophy, we do not regard the three paths as mutually exclusive, as competing ways or schools, but rather as three aspects of the one path, three necessary elements in the total discipline by which the spiritual goal is to be achieved. We were reminded also that the path of spiritual knowledge was already examined last Sunday, and that knowledge is a necessary ingredient in proper action. We were also reminded, though that study as a whole comes later, that a feeling of dedication, a feeling of devotion is also a necessary ingredient in the performance of the highest actions. Granted all this, how does the Gita enter the discussion of action? It does so because Arjuna asks the obvious question after the second chapter. In the second chapter, the presence of the immortal self has been discussed. And then Arjuna says, but Krishna, if the reality is on that plane, if you speak of spiritual knowledge as the great thing, then why are you asking me to take up this terrific action? Because after all, the whole dialogue is meant to induce Arjuna to get on with the war, to pick up again the divine bow and arrows which he has put down. So then Krishna speaks to him, and the central part of that answer we heard today as the devotional reading. Now, one important point there is that human beings misconceive the choice, because Sri Krishna says, no one ever resteth a moment inactive. So anyway, there is not a question of choosing between action and inaction in a literal way. Why is this? We get the answer later in the chapter. We also heard that read in the devotional reading, where Sri Krishna says that he is indefatigable in action. The divine principle in the very act of causing this universe to manifest sets forth action. In fact, it has been described as the only true perpetual motion. You know that in ordinary science, perpetual motion is considered an impossibility. Whereas in occult science or in spiritual tradition, there is a perpetual motion. That is the vibration which lasts from the very first stroke of a manvantara through the whole process of involution, that is manifestation or pravritti, and backwards to the whole second arc of evolution, nivritti, right back till the dissolution of the universe into the one reality again. And in this respect, science itself has seen the truth and put forward the law of the conservation of energy. That is, no energy can vanish out of existence. All that happens is that units of energy change their forms or the direction in which they act. And this is why in the universe we have entities, things, beings, and also laws and forces and ways of action. All of that is simply the play of the one energy, the one action. This is why it is wonderful that in Indian tradition, the word karma is used to discuss both action
and its moral consequences. Because action is a kind of fundamental substratum of the universe itself. No action, no universe. Then, what is the human being taught to do? Sri Krishna says, look, there is a wheel which has been set in motion. Strictly speaking, divinity has done this. Krishna says, I have done it. But I, in the Bhagavad Gita, in many contexts, represents the Logos, the first point of manifestation that arises within the Absolute. So, Sri Krishna representing the Divine says, I have done it. I have set this wheel in motion. Essentially, it's a wheel of sacrifice. Because, as he says, there is nothing that I needed to get. There is nothing in the three worlds which I have not already obtained. Or there is no unfulfilled duty that I have now got an obligation to fulfill. It is an act of pure sacrifice or pure grace. This we must grasp. The mere existence of the universe is an act of sacrifice or an act of grace on the part of the reality, of the one reality. This is not the time to go into it, but students may find it interesting to study some of the rather difficult things which are said about the nature of yajna or sacrifice in the notes in the glossary. The note on yajna in the glossary has some very interesting hints about it. And the very odd sentence in the Upanishads, which is often chanted without much discussion or understanding. Yajnena yajnam ayajanta deva. The gods perform the sacrifice by means of sacrifice. This curious sentence, it needs thinking about it, because sacrifice is one of the fundamental supports of existence. Sri Krishna's advice to Arjuna, and therefore to all men whom Arjuna represents, is don't forget to do your part in continuing, in causing this wheel to continue revolving. You have your part to do. It doesn't depend on you in the sense that you make it. It's already there. The very existence of the universe means this wheel of sacrifice which the Divine has set going. You have to do it. If you don't, then what happens is that a certain contradiction, a certain conflict arises between your essential nature as a being who has come as a ray from the Divine, your essential nature and the outward nature which you create by your actions. A contradiction will arise between these two. That contradiction is sin. That contradiction is the kind of demerit or papa which leads to unfavorable karmic results. Here in one place the example given is very simple. After having referred to the kind of worship established by Prajapati, one of the lords of creation. There are many sons of Brahma who are called Prajapati. Sri Krishna says, after that, he includes the, well, in that worship there is the principle that we get so much from the gods, that is, from the great powers and intelligences which preside over the processes of nature. Our whole life depends on that. He says, but there is a way in which human beings can in turn help and nourish and cherish the gods by their appropriate sacrifices, by their appropriate action. It says that with what you get, with this nourish the gods. That's a very strange thing, but we can appreciate it these days, that man and nature must nourish one another. And there Prajapati says, he who enjoyeth what had been given unto him by them, meaning the gods, the powers of nature, and offereth not a portion unto them, is even as a thief. He has falsified the relationship. He must offer back a portion of what he has received. And so, those who dress their meat but for themselves eat the bread of sin, being themselves sin incarnate. This is Sri Krishna's essential teaching about action. It's not that he says you must act. That he takes for granted. No man resteth a moment inactive. But he has explained how action is part of an eternal divine pattern, part of an eternal divine structure, where the action proceeds from sacrifice, from compassion, and human beings are created within that pattern, and therefore, if they don't share this attitude of nourishing other beings, nourishing even the gods, and certainly other weaker beings, then they falsify their own nature. Something goes wrong with their own nature. And that going wrong, that internal contradiction, is sin. In a place, in a footnote, in the Secret Doctrine, HPB says that ultimately, sin, the word, is related simply to selfishness. There are many definitions, many codes in different cultures and all that, but when you analyze the thing far enough, and it's also related, oddly enough, to the moon, because the lunar nature of man is supposed to be that changeable lower nature which tempts him into performing selfish action. But leaving that symbolism aside, sin is connected directly with selfishness. Of course, it doesn't mean that every time a human being acts selfishly, he's a sinner in the rather strong sense which religions sometimes give to the word, but that is the ultimate point. Because you see, ultimately a human being is either going to be in harmony with his own higher nature, which is not individual. The Atman is not my Atman or your Atman or his Atman or her Atman. The Atman is the one self of all creatures. It expresses itself in an individual in a particular mode, and certainly from one end of a Mahamanvantara to another there is an individual line of spiritual evolution. This is what we refer to as the monad or the reincarnating ego in different contexts, different terms have to be used. So there is a spiritual individuality, very important. And of course it's quite different from our ordinary visible personality, which after all lasts only for one lifetime. The spiritual individuality is there through the whole course of many reincarnations and the final achievement of failure. Nevertheless, this spiritual individuality knows that it is not separate from the one self, that it is only a particular mode of expression of that one self, just as every other individual is another style of expression of that one self. The idea of the self of all creatures is fundamental to the very doctrine of the Atma. Otherwise, we would get a very funny situation in which every self is eternal and immortal, and there are millions of such selves with no connection with one another. This is philosophically speaking not possible. They would still have to ask, but where do all these immortal selves come from? And they do come from the one divinity and are not cut off from it. We imagine as having a lot of other selves cut off from it. You can't imagine it like that at all. So, this idea of action is really an idea of maintaining the human self on all its levels. The spiritual individuality, the conscious man who makes moral choices, and his personality which has to be educated and purified as you go along. On all these levels, he has to be brought into harmony with his essential nature as an emanation from divinity on its return path thereto. Now, this, as it were, is the framework within which action is discussed. And so the major thing that Krishna says is action as sacrifice. Now, there's something else that comes. we mentioned the moral law of karma. Now here, Krishna says, three things in three brief sentences in this translation, very significantly, one after another. Look, do thou perform the proper actions. Action is superior to inaction. Plain guidance. Number two, the journey of thy mortal frame cannot be accomplished by inaction. This is the metaphysical reason for the previous command. Do thou perform the proper actions. Then, all actions performed other than as sacrifice unto God make the actor bound by action. Abandon then, O son of Kunti, all selfish motives, and inaction perform thy duty for him alone. This is Krishna's solution to the problem that Arjuna has put forward, or to the problem that all religious life involves. The problem is that when you perform an action, certain consequences will follow. There may be good consequences, there may be sattvic consequences, but consequences will follow. In order to fulfill those consequences, in order to experience those results, another birth may have to be taken. And so this whole business, this cycle of births and deaths continues. And of course it is one of the goals of religious philosophy on the ordinary level to look for release from the cycle of births and deaths. That is what you mean by moksha or liberation. Therefore people get into something which is an error, but an understandable error, which has always been there, which is, then let's stop getting involved. Let us withdraw as much as possible. Let's perform as few actions as possible. And the other side of this becomes the other side of the coin. Let us perform only those actions which are specifically prescribed by the Shastras, by scriptures and by tradition, etc. And so, into this problem of action, what you may proper, in fact the chapter is called Karma Yoga. Into this you get something else, which in India was called Karma Kanda, also related to karma or action. Karma Kanda. This was very much the thing propounded by a school previous to the great Vedanta school. This one was called Purva Mimamsa, and it is said traditionally that Shankaracharya in his great debates defeated the chief leaders of the school and established Uttara Mimamsa or Vedanta. This previous school kept on saying that the only safe thing is to do your morning sandhya at that particular hour which is prescribed by the Shastras, to take your bath so and so, to do this, to do that. Everything was prescribed. Now, this misunderstanding of action is really the result of being afraid. Afraid to make your own choice and take the consequences. The people who did this were not cynics or skeptics. That would be different if they had been. But they were people who believed profoundly in a very tight law of karma. But they were so afraid to make any choices of their own that they... No, everything must be done exactly as prescribed. This is a misunderstanding because it talks as if action happens only on the plane of action of the body. So we have to glance a little at the relation between body and mind and feelings in discussing action. Now, of course, all students of theosophy know that the mind or thought is the real plane of action, because that is where action is conceived. That is where you really choose what is going to be done, you decide on the shape of what is going to be done, and so on. On the other hand, all students of theosophy also know that there is such a thing as thought which doesn't lead anywhere, mere intention. And we know how even the masters of wisdom have said that they are not impressed by fine words. They look to the actual actions. They say this in more than one letter. And we know how HPB in the Key to Theosophy has quoted with great approval Carlyle, who said, "The end of man is not a thought, even though it is a noble thing, but an act." These two aspects, these two ways of looking at thought and action. What theosophy teaches is that to do that, you must also take into account the nature of will, which is actually this energy that we were talking about, the one energy by means of which the universe is projected. The will is the directive aspect of that energy. Now, students of theosophy technically know it as the phoatic will, which, where spirit and matter meet in such a way that intelligent action proceeds, is launched. Now, in the individual, this will is most often, we take it in small units and dilute it, and it works under the pressure of our personal desires and feelings. But the great poetic will is still there within the individual, latent, not working. This is what the sadhaka, the proper spiritually aspirant, is trying to get hold of and awaken. And if you were to really do it, then the creative will, as it is called, Mr. Crosby has an interesting lecture on that, under that heading in the book, The Friendly. Then the creative will would awaken and he would recreate himself, he would remake his personality and his individual nature in such a way that it is perfectly aligned with the cosmic creative will. And then, as is sometimes said in stories, the word of a sage never proves false. He merely says something, it will happen. In fact, one aspect of the creative will is called Kriya Shakti, which is a real entity or a real force. Now, this is inherent in the divinity, it is inherent in Phohat, it is inherent in the higher nature of human beings, this creative will. But in practice, because our mind is not attuned to the higher impersonal immortal nature, it's not available. And because that mind is so often mixed up with our personal feelings and desires, the small trickle of force which we get, the small trickle of will, is really behind will stands desire. That way, that's the way it works. Now, in the ordinary way, if we were to only perform certain actions, we would find that yes, originally we decided to do it, like do a sandhya every morning, have a bath at a certain. Very soon, this would be delegated to that automatic working of the will in the cells of our body and the brain, and very little of the real mind would be involved. From a different point of view, in last Sunday's study, we saw that story of the cat which used to be tied up and so on, how outer habitual actions become stereotyped and fixed mechanical formulae. And therefore, they do not cause, they do not awaken anything within. Once when somebody planned it, there was a reason for it. But now if you keep on repeating them, nothing happens. Nothing much happens. People bring Ganesha images by the thousand into their homes in Bombay, and 1.5 days later or 5 days later or 10 days later or 11 days later, they go and immerse them. And there is no particular difference that one can see in the degree of their study of wisdom in any sense, either during those 10 days or afterwards. Why? Because the thing is done purely externally. One doesn't ask for the inner meaning. That is why Sri Krishna has to say, look, actual action is necessary. Otherwise, you may delude yourself. Actual absence of action is itself not final. We get that very stern warning that if somebody does not behave sensually, does not grab actual physical pleasures, but in his mind, in his heart, he's pondering on images of those sensual pleasures, then he's a false pietist, a bewildered soul. He may have deprived himself of the external satisfaction or gratification, but he has not inwardly given up. So negatively it works that way. Positively, if you do empty karma kanda, you've not done anything about your consciousness. So true action is that where the whole nature of man flows in a proper unison, drawing upon the energy of the divine creative will which is there in the man, letting it flow unobstructed through his own mind and feelings, so that finally it even directs his physical action. So that finally even his body will not do anything wrong left to itself instinctively. Because after all, the body itself is made up of tiny units which are living, which are alive. If every elemental were so purified, so trained, you remember how later, in a later chapter in the Gita, it says that there are five things involved in action, and there is endless argument about the fifth element, Daivatra Panchamam. That is really the tiny beings, non-human, immortal, but not wise or self-conscious, Divya beings, whose performance on their own level, of their own actions, is necessary for the functioning of the human body, the human astral body, the human mind, feelings, etc. They are the hosts of energies. As it were, what we call one man is always really a commander of a whole army. And the army consists of beings at different levels. Some of them are very simple, some are more subtle, more advanced. But it's a whole army. And this is why we sometimes find it difficult to change our line of action, even when we want to. Because the whole army has got used to your acting in a certain direction. They have got impressions, they have got tendencies of their own. Then at the mental level we decide, no, this is not right, I want to do something else tomorrow. But it takes time to change the tendencies and training of a whole army. It takes time. They have no knowledge, they have no conscience. They are just energies, but very pure and direct. They won't suddenly change their own nature. So they are reliable in that sense, that they will carry on according to their own nature, they will carry on according to the impressions we have given them. They are sensitive to human thoughts and feelings, but they have no conscience, they have no judgment of their own. These are the things which technically in theosophy are called elementals, that is to say, they are the intelligent or consciousness aspect of the elements, the five great elements, earth, water, air, fire and akasha. Obviously, those which belong to fire and akasha are more subtle and more pure than those which belong to earth or water. But still, none of them has self-consciousness or none of them has moral judgment. We have to impress on them the appropriate directions, the tendencies which we want to do. Ultimately, this can be done to such an extent that the very body of a sage is luminous. It puts out a kind of light because it reflects the light of wisdom within. Now, in action, therefore, we have seen there is a question of tuning ourselves to a cosmic action which is already going on. There is no question of our not acting. But there is a question of tuning our individual action to that cosmic action which is going on. Does this mean there is no freedom? What about then karma? That as a law of moral retribution, as a moral responsibility? Not at all. That is very real. In that great literary work, The Lord of the Rings, the sage Gandalf says in one place, it is wisdom to recognize necessity. The cosmic order is there, you can't change it. In that sense, it is necessity. But to realize it, to recognize it, and to consent willingly that you will adjust your action to that cosmic order, that is wisdom. Whereas if you have no wisdom, if you don't care, if you want to follow your own likes and dislikes and prejudices, you are free to do that. But the laws of nature will not change. The very structure of your own body will not change. I mean, I can say what I like and eat far too many sweets. I am free to do that. But the structure of my body being what it is, the results will follow. At least the tummy ache will follow. So that I can't change that. So, because the cosmic action is law, there are two levels on which we get reactions from what we do. One is, our action as such produces a reaction that is elementary. Because there are forces involved, those forces will react. Otherwise, you can't maintain the principle of the conservation of energy. If you push energy and produce a modification in one direction, there is a reaction. That is simply a part of the principle of the conservation of energy. But then, energy and pulling and pushing and all that don't happen only on the external or material level, whether physical or astral. It also happens on the level of consciousness or thought and feeling. Now, on that level, it is much more a matter of motive than of what you do. Obviously, the merely external physical action tells you very little. If I were to use a sentence like, a man cut somebody else's arm for 6 inches with a knife, you would wonder, you would probably think I am describing a crime which happened in Bombay yesterday. But actually, but the same thing you might say, the incision made was 6 inches long, and the next sentence might be, and the surgeon stitched it up with this and this. So you see, the action tells you very little. It is the thought behind it, the motive behind it, and so on. Mr. Judge points out that when you are asleep, your body falls into postures and positions which you wouldn't permit it to do if you were awake. The body by itself doesn't know this. But that same sleeping body maintains very accurately complicated processes that keep your heart and your breathing and your digestion going normally. So in one way, it has no sense. It has no sense of decency or taste or appearance. But its own internal process, it manages very well. So every level has its own proper kind of consciousness and its pattern of activity. We have to recognize this. And then in terms of freedom, we therefore find that freedom really comes at the level of the mind. And so it is said, thoughts are the seeds of karma. According to the thought behind the action, there is going to be a moral retribution. There is going to be a consequence, because the moral quality of an action is part of the facts. It is part of the cause that you have produced. It's not as if the action is the same, but different people think it is moral or immoral. They may. But also in real fact, the thing is moral or immoral. In real fact, it is in tune with the cosmic pattern or not. It is in tune with your higher nature or not. And therefore, if it is not in tune, something will happen which will begin to press it back into its proper position. Because the universe is not going to let you, meaning let any individual, push it into a state of disharmony. And if you start doing it, you know what will happen. Like a friend of mine who once said, he was driving a small car, a Morris Minor car. And he said, yes, I have to be very careful on this road because there are big buses and lorries coming along. And if I have an argument with one of them, you know what will happen. So it's like that. If you have an argument with the universal pattern, you know what will happen. You will come off second best. You will be the one who will be pushed out. The universe is not going to become different. This is what we call karma. The fact that the universe reasserts its own harmony. The moment you disturb it even slightly, it reasserts it. In the process, we find that we are either enjoying or suffering the result. Why does it come to us in particular? Because at the moment of starting the cause, we were taking the position of a separate individual entity. The one who had the right to make a choice. The one who said, but I decide. It is said that sages can do actions which do not come to them because at the moment of doing them, they are not taking the position of a separate individual. They are only taking the position of, this is what is needed in terms of the divine intention. This is what is needed in terms of the divine pattern of the cosmos. The energy which is at my disposal has come from that divine. I direct it to go ahead with in terms of the divine plan. Therefore, as it were, they are mere channels, transmitters, through whom the divine will acts, and there is no personal karma involved. But they have added something to the beneficent side of the collective karma of the universe. For them to do this is a kind of sacrifice, because they have involved themselves. When they do this, and a beneficent aspect of collective karma is increased, the fact remains that they have attached themselves, they have linked themselves with collective humanity, and therefore some of the evil things that collective humanity does, now they have to take also. They have done no evil, they are sinless, but they have to take it merely because they have linked themselves with collective humanity. And then you get the odd things like Jesus getting crucified or very great sages dying of cancer. Very, very odd things happen. Sometimes these are simply the result of their taking some of the bad karma of collective mankind, which they do only because they are involved in order to give collective karma the benefit of their positive intervention. So action permits this. In fact, as Sri Krishna says, action is meant to do this. Action is meant for the individual to contribute to the wheel revolving. The sacrificial action of divinity has started the wheel going. Individuals who understand spiritual teaching contribute to keeping the wheel revolving. In doing so, of course, they must watch their own actions, and we know how the Gita says that of course you must do your duty, but over and above your duty there are three kinds of action you should never give up: dana, charity, tapas, self-discipline, mortification, that kind of thing, and yajna, sacrifice. Dana, yajna and tapas are three types of action that a human being should never give up. So, in all this, then the Gita philosophy of action brings you back to the level of consciousness, because it continually balances action with the motive. All action performed other than as sacrifice unto God binds the man. What is performed as sacrifice does not bind a man. It brings the whole idea of action back to the level of the heart quality, the motive, the sacrifice. And it is where these two meet. That is, spiritual perception and right and pure action, it's where they meet that devotion becomes really possible. Otherwise, devotion is in danger of becoming simply emotion. But devotion becomes possible in the real sense, where spiritual perception and real action come together. And Theosophy teaches that they have thus come together, especially in the work of those who are called bodhisattvas, nirmanakayas. These are terms out of Buddhist tradition, but the idea is that there is a level of spiritual achievement at which the one who has achieved realization, the one who is capable of both spiritual knowledge and spiritual action, decides to exercise his knowledge and his power of action on the higher planes in order to improve the general quality of the collective karma of mankind, in order to become part of what is called the guardian wall. Mankind would be in a much worse condition than it is now if it was left to itself. It is the gracious, the sacrificial intervention of great sages and spiritually high beings that holds back to some extent the forces of darkness. And the great guardian wall, therefore, means. Now, it is in those who are units in the guardian wall, who have constituted themselves the protectors, the guardians, the elder brothers of mankind, the great sages, the Buddhas and Christs. It is in them that you see truly the perfection of both knowledge and action. Not as against the kind of achievement in knowledge which we think of on the part of a scholar or a learned man, or the kind of great skill in action which we think of as on the part of somebody like Napoleon or Alexander. These are fragmentary things. The real combination of action and thought comes when the action proceeds from a spiritual source and therefore takes the whole world along with itself, a step towards its own goal, which is also spiritual. Therefore, the culmination of all the three paths, jnana, karma and bhakti, is the renunciation of one's own spiritual peace and bliss, which is made by spiritual beings at the highest level. We can now have a few questions. The ritual. Our friend says, in the Mahabharata there seems to be a description of a ritual performed before the war. There should be some meaning. Yes, there should be, but this minute I do not recall what the ritual exactly was. You must remember that in those days, which is, by the way, the Mahabharata is not one of the highest levels of Indian history, because it is happening towards the end of the Dwapara Yuga. And though Krishna is present, mankind is neither in the Satya Yuga or the Golden Age, nor even in the Treta Yuga or the Second Silver Age, which was the age of the Ramayana. It is towards the end of the third or Bronze Age, and Kali Yuga is about to begin. That just to... Now, what tended to happen was that sometimes rituals and ceremonies were performed in order to get something which you wanted. There are plenty of examples in the Mahabharata. A man who performs this because he wants such and such a kind of son. And it's not very sensible, because sometimes he wants a son capable of executing his revenge on such and such a person who's once defeated him. All that kind of story also comes into the Mahabharata. So just because a ritual shows extraordinary occult knowledge, it doesn't mean it's on a high spiritual level. So rituals, yes. No, actually, the interesting thing about the Mahabharata war is that it began at a certain level, at least, of chivalrous principles. Bhishma laid down the rules, and those rules were followed up to a certain point in the war. Then, two incidents. One, the killing of Abhimanyu, surrounded by six or seven elder warriors. And then, in Arjuna's reaction, where he killed Jayadratha, but by the intervention of a trick which Krishna used really. Arjuna was not able to do it himself, but Krishna did it. From these two points onwards, the original chivalric rules were given up. For example, it was a rule that at sunset fighting stopped. And people could visit each other's camps and all that socialize. That's all that. After Jayadratha was killed, Duryodhana said, what nonsense, Arjuna has done this. Now we'll get torches and continue fighting at night. So, the Rajaji points out, Rajaji has, you know, written a series of little notes on the Mahabharata, giving many incidents and also comments. He points out that it shows how once you start a thing like a war, the existing level of culture comes down. It is very difficult to maintain even the ordinary human level of culture which is there at the beginning. There was chivalry about the beginning of the Mahabharata war, like a senior warrior would not attack somebody who was less equipped, you know, a Maharathi would not attack an ordinary Padarthi, but many of those rules failed. Well, we tried to suggest one of the things which happens